TexasObserver.org. You're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing and say things to you on the radio instead. This week, we've got Observer editor Dave Mann with us. Hey, Dave.
Hello.
Also with us is Melissa Del Bosque, one of our staff writers. Glad you could both make it. How's it going?
Good to be here.
Excellent. Later in the show, we'll be joined by freelance writer Saul Elbein to discuss License to Kill, a story that asks what legal responsibility hospitals have to keep dangerous doctors from operating. Still later, we'll be joined by Lupita Correa Cabrera, the head of the government department at UT Brownsville, to talk about Mexico's plan to save the state of Tamaulipas, which has been under a near constant threat of violence since 2010. But first, we have some news to discuss. We've spent the last few episodes starting off with discussions about the lieutenant governor's race, and this week we've got more fuel for the fire. On May 15th, documents about Dan Patrick's mental history were leaked. Dave, can you give us the rundown on that story?
Yeah, the lieutenant governor's race is getting more and more interesting, and by that we mean nastier.
Right.
As we get closer to the runoff election, which is on Tuesday, we're recording this on Thursday. Mm-hmm. So this coming Tuesday is the election. Whoever wins between David Dewhurst, the incumbent, and Dan Patrick, our state senator from Houston, will be the heavy favorite to be our next lieutenant governor, although they'll face Letitia Van de Putte in the general election, but there, you know, whoever wins the runoff on Tuesday is the heavy favorite. So the stakes are high, and because of that, it is getting nasty here in the last couple of weeks. And the latest development, as you mentioned, is this kind of brouhaha over health records of Dan Patrick's that were leaked. And later came out, were kind of basically leaked by Jerry Patterson, who is a defeated candidate for lieutenant governor who has made no secret of his dislike, hatred, you might say, for Dan Patrick.
Yeah, we talked about his campaign ad last week with the minute-long sort of look at his gun collection.
Yes, yes. Jerry Patterson, well-known for his fascination with guns and his hatred for Dan Patrick. And so he's endorsed David Dewhurst. He's working with the Dewhurst campaign. And apparently got a hold of basically a deposition from a libel lawsuit from the 1980s in which Dan Patrick talks about some of his struggles with depression and says that he had been hospitalized for a stretch of a couple of weeks with depression. There was talk of a suicide attempt. And basically this was outed by Jerry Patterson as a way of saying, okay, Dan Patrick is not fit to be lieutenant governor. Now, of course, this was problematic because, you know, it's from the 80s. It's 30 years ago.
Right.
And the Dan Patrick campaign came out with a note basically from Dan Patrick's doctor saying he's had no problems with depression since then. He's gotten past it. And I think a lot of people saw this as, you know, a very common struggle with depression, you know, the kind of struggle that a lot of people have, and something that Dan Patrick has kind of gotten past, and something that doesn't have a lot of relevance to what kind of lieutenant governor he'd be, doesn't have a lot of relevance to the election. But it became a controversy over, well, what kind of campaign is David Dewhurst running, right? I mean, this is really nasty stuff. So it kind of blew back on Dewhurst. And so
I thought the Mountain Dew ads were bad enough.
Yeah, well,
and yet here
yeah,
we are.
Yeah, we've had a lot of bad stuff in this race. And so Chris Hooks, our politics writer, had an interesting post this week about the awkward position that David Dewhurst finds himself in, where he's desperate to win. He's desperate to hold on to his position as lieutenant governor, and yet he's also trying to like keep the Dan Patrick attacks at arm's length, right? He's trying to condemn the release of the Dan Patrick mental health records and at the same time take advantage of it.
Right.
So it's a very awkward position where he's like saying, well, you know, this doesn't have any place in the election, but also trying to take advantage of it. And he put out this weird statement about how, you know, his thoughts and prayers go out to Dan Patrick and his family for having to deal with this. So it's just the whole thing is looking bad for Dewhurst, and Dan Patrick is still kind of the overwhelming favorite right now going into the final days. But it's a kind of a fascinating human drama, both on the Dan Patrick front and also kind of the awkward position that, that Dewhurst finds himself in.
Yeah, I think Dewhurst really, really fumbled with it. And he's always been so wooden anyway with the media and with the public. Like, he's always had this sort of awkward distance between him and the rest of the world. So he really did not come off well, I think, in trying to distance himself from this.
Well, and this after a public debate in which he repeatedly asked Dan Patrick if he was okay in a really odd way, I thought.
Well, asked if he had any... snake oil for his hair loss.
Right.
This kind of comment, like, I mean, people have talked about Dan Patrick being a snake oil salesman, and he's got a little bit of that to him. So you can kind of see where Dewhurst is coming from, but it was just random comment out of nowhere in the middle of what was a very nasty debate, their second to last debate. And yeah, and he keeps asking, "Are you okay, Dan? Are you okay?" And then comes out of the blue with this comment of, "Well, do you have snake oil for the hair loss too?"
Right.
Which is just, the whole thing is bizarre. And I think you're right, Melissa. Dewhurst has always been awkward and strange to the media. And his denials of him not being involved with the release of the records and yet at the same time trying to take advantage of it have been totally awkward and fumbled. And then there was this email that was inadvertently sent out to the press in which Dre Patterson is urging the Dewhurst campaign to release these records and take advantage of it, and talking about David Dewhurst being indecisive and saying Dewhurst's indecision shouldn't stand in the way of them taking advantage of these health records from Dan Patrick. So the whole thing came off, you know, Dewhurst came off looking kind of weak and indecisive and fumbling, which is, you know, par for the course and why he's
awkward.
He's trailing, you know.
Well, real quick, we have a few minutes left, and I want to talk about one other legislative story, and that is Senator Robert Duncan has decided to step down. What does his departure mean for the makeup of the Senate and the next legislative session?
Well, it probably means a greater shift to the right, mm-hmm, in the Texas Senate. And you know, this kind of thing takes on a lot more importance and interest because of how much the Texas Senate is moving to the right. And it ties back into the Dan Patrick Dewhurst race, because if Dan Patrick wins and becomes lieutenant governor, I mean, he's kind of straight out of the Tea Party grassroots. That's his constituency. He's going to be the most right-wing lieutenant governor we've probably ever seen, both in terms of legislation and process, you know, doing away with the two-thirds rule, mm-hmm, stripping Democrats of their chairmanships. And then in other parts of the Senate, we've seen more moderate Republicans like John Corona in Dallas. He lost his primary. He's being replaced by a Tea Party candidate. And now you've got Bob Duncan from Lubbock, who, you know, is a very pretty moderate Republican, but he's basically known in the Senate as a deal maker. You know, he's one of these guys who's not flashy. If you've ever heard Bob Duncan talk, you know that he is not flashy at all. Just very soft-spoken, doesn't really make headlines, but is one of these guys who works behind the scenes. And Melissa, you know this better than anybody. I mean, works behind the scenes to kind of help craft compromise and craft legislation. And the kind of guy you need to have, you know, the kind of politician you need to have in the legislature just to get things done. And as we've seen more and more ideologues come into the Texas Senate, losing somebody like Bob Duncan is a real loss, and we'll probably not only see a more ideological, more right-wing person take his place, but somebody that maybe isn't as much of a compromiser and a coalition builder as Duncan was. So it kind of plays into this larger trend of the Texas Senate really becoming a chamber dominated by the Tea Party, especially if Dan Patrick is running it.
Melissa, real quick, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, in the piece that Chris Hooks did, where he refers to, you know, Senator Williams as a moderate, so that shows you how far we've come, you know, and how far right the Senate's getting. And I was kind of, I guess, shocked by Chris's piece also, that how many moderate Republican senators are not coming back. That Tommy Williams is going to go work for a university. Senator Duncan's going to go work for a university. So, I mean, I worked for a Democratic senator, and actually we were in the office right next door to Senator Duncan. And it's important to have those deal makers, people who will reach across the aisle to reach a consensus. And if you have people who aren't willing to do that, then we're going to have a really divisive legislative session next year.
Yeah, I don't think anybody would describe Tommy Williams as a moderate, but that's kind of the role he took on because he was willing to actually work with other people to pass legislation, pass the budget. And he's probably going to be replaced by a more right-wing senator. And losing Corona, now losing Duncan. Wendy Davis's seat will probably be taken by a Tea Party candidate. So, and then Bob Dole, who once upon a time was like one of the most conservative senators, mm-hmm. he's being primaried by a Tea Party candidate, and we'll see what happens in that race on Tuesday. But yeah, you've got potential for a really radically right-wing upper chamber in the legislature next session.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. Way back in August of 2013, freelance writer Saul Elbein penned the tale of Dr. Christopher Dunch, a surgeon whose patients ended up maimed or dead. The story suggested that the true tragedy is that the Texas Medical Board could not stop him from practicing. Mr. Elbein's new story, License to Kill, continues the story by examining what legal responsibility a hospital has to keep a dangerous doctor from operating. To help us answer that question, we have Saul Elbein with us. Welcome, Saul.
Thank you.
So before we answer that question, Saul, do you mind giving us a little summary of Dr. Dunch's career?
Sure. So Dunch was a neurosurgeon who was trained in Tennessee and moved to Dallas to start his career and started at Baylor. And while he was at Baylor, the legal wording here is a little bit tricky, but several of his patients ended up seriously injured. One was crippled and one was killed. And so then he quit Baylor. There was apparently no investigation, and then proceeded to hop around hospital after hospital in the Dallas area, where several more of his patients ended up crippled and another one died. So it was 18 months between the first botched surgery and the time that the Texas Medical Board actually took his license. The first piece that we did looked at why, and what we found was that there's actually very little in the way of regulation of doctors in Texas. It's pretty much entirely left up to the Texas Medical Board, which is a licensing board.
Right.
Second story, that License to Kill looks at the question of how we got to the point in which doctors are basically where hospitals are basically shielded from regulation or from lawsuit for the doctors that they allow to practice.
Right, and so the story is somewhat focused on some of Dr. Dunch's former patients and what they're trying to do to actually change the law. But there's also this whole concept of tort reform. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Tort reform is the idea that of changing the way that liabilities are dealt with in court. So, and that's what torts are. They're damages in which one party has to pay for the harm that they've caused another. And what the tort reform proponents started saying in the early 90s is that torts were out of control, that that these sort of cabal of nefarious trial lawyers were suing the pants off of corporations and hospitals based on these totally frivolous lawsuits, and it was costing people a lot of money. And that, in the case of the medical system, it was causing doctors to leave the state because it was driving up their malpractice insurance. And so they pushed to seriously restrict patients' ability to sue doctors. And this was pitched as being a way of reining in lawsuit abuses. But the problem is that in Texas, there really is not a very strong governmental system of regulation. And most of what we had was a tort system that, you know, if somebody wronged you, you could take them to court. And the reforms that were put in place in the mid to late 90s and very early 2000s pretty much stripped those all away.
So what recourse do patients like those who were operated on by Dr. Dunch have at this point?
Well, so I want to be clear here. Your ability to successfully sue a doctor has been reduced. The caps you can win are very reduced. But that's not what my piece was on. What my piece was mostly on was the question of whether hospitals are liable for the doctors that they allow to practice. So we're talking about a patient who is suing Baylor, not necessarily one who is suing Dr. Dunch. That's
right.
Important in this case partly because Dr. Dunch is bankrupt, doesn't have any money. It's also relevant because under the way the law is set up currently, a hospital has complete immunity from prosecution, or not prosecution, but from liability for the doctors that they let practice. So the answer is nothing. There is nothing that you can do.
And that's pretty, I mean, it can be pretty egregious because, as you mentioned, the regulation in Texas is pretty lax. So one deterrent to bad care, one way to kind of protect patients is this notion that, well, if there's bad treatment, if a doctor is, produces malpractice, or if a hospital allows an incompetent or bad doctor to practice knowingly, then they can be held liable for it. They can pay for it. So in theory, there'd be a financial disincentive to allowing bad doctors to continue to practice. But as you kind of mentioned in the story, hospitals have basically become shielded in Texas from liability. They've set a bar so high that plaintiffs can't seem to meet it. So, you know, what's basically the practical outcome of that? You know, what's the outcome of shielding these hospitals?
Well, part of it is the hospitals have a strong financial incentive to hire doctors who perform a lot of surgeries without any corresponding disincentive to keep the bad ones out. So that's a problem. Like that strikes me as a real problem. And it's especially a problem because in most places, the doctors are independent contractors. So you can't hold the hospitals liable in the way that you would hold a business liable for the behavior of their employees.
And in your story, in Dunch's case, it seemed like there were several instances where the hospitals knew or probably should have known that Dunch was dangerous and were getting reports from other surgeons, from nurses, that he was doing not just bad surgeries, but like incredibly botched surgeries. Like people wondered about how it's possible that he could bungle it this badly, right?
Yeah, well, after he performed a surgery on Barry Morgeloff with Dr. Randall Kirby's reaction was, it was like he was a first-year resident. Like, it wasn't even clear that he'd finished his residency. I mean, there were doctors who wondered if he'd really gone to medical school. I mean, we're talking like not, which is a pretty egregious level of bad care. These didn't sound like super questionable cases. But I do want to say, I want to say sort of in Baylor's defense, that the pattern is much more evident 2 years later, you know, after there's been a trail of bodies. You know, I think it's much harder in the noise to figure out what's going on. And that's part of the problem. It's that you can, you know, if your eyes are elsewhere, you can miss what's going on unless somebody's making you pay attention, and nobody is.
But there was also the instance where they, you know, the hospitals let Dunch go without really firing him, without really showing that he had been dismissed. And so he kind of was able to go to another hospital and keep practicing. And it reminds me a little bit of kind of what happened in the Catholic Church with some of the, you know, abuse cases where priests who were known to be abusive were allowed to go to other dioceses.
And this case is going to be really interesting because I think we're going to see what actually happened at Baylor. Because all we know right now is that Dunch left and then he got a job at Dallas Medical Center. And we don't know what conversations happened, if any conversations happened, what the internal deliberations were, what discussions happened between Dunch and Baylor. And part of the reason we don't know any of that is because it's privileged. A lot of it's privileged.
Right.
And hopefully we'll get some of it in deposition.
Well, Saul, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Good being here.
The story is License to Kill. You can read it on texasobserver.org. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. The Mexican state of Tamaulipas has been under the threat of violence since 2010. Now, President Enrique Peña Nieto has a plan to save the state, but similar plans have been tried before and ultimately resulted in more violence. To help us discuss this story, we have with us staff writer Melissa Del Bosque. Hey, Melissa.
Hi.
And joining us via phone is UT Brownsville professor Lupita Correa Cabrera. Thank you so much for being on the show, Lupita.
Hello. Hi.
So, Melissa, give us the rundown on this story.
Sure. Last week, some of the Mexican president's top military advisors arrived in Tamaulipas, in the city of Reynosa. And Tamaulipas is the state, it's our closest neighbor to Texas. And they have been having a lot of problems with cartel problems with the Gulf cartel and the Zeta splitting and a lot of gun battles and so forth. And just recently there's been a lot of, the violence has really spiked again. There's been a lot of deaths and gun battles and blockades. So the Mexico's president announced that they had this new security plan. So the military advisors came last week and announced it in Tamaulipas that they would split the state into four parts. And two of those parts will be run by Army generals and the other two by Navy generals. And each section will have its own federal attorney who will investigate crimes. So theoretically, it sounds like something is being done.
Right.
But in the piece that I just put up on The Observer and where I interview Professor Correa Cabrera is questioning, you know, we've seen them do these military takeovers in other states and things have not gone well. It's violence has spiked, human rights abuses have spiked.
Can you give us an example?
Well, for instance, in Juarez, mm-hmm. in 2009, 2010, you know, Juarez was the highest, they had the highest murder rate in the world. There was a lot of coverage, foreign coverage also of the violence there, and a lot of human rights abuses with the military there. They took the guns away from the local police and they took over the law enforcement, but you know, it didn't, the violence didn't get, you know, better. It got worse, actually. So.
Was that in reaction to the military's presence or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, this is a very interesting observation. Definitely, when you reinforce the operations with federal forces, with the military, with the Navy, you would have a confrontation between the groups and the state. In the case of Tamaulipas, we see now that a fragmentation of the two main drug cartels, the Gulf Cartel and the Zeta. Not a war between the two groups as we saw it in 2010. However, it's true when you have the federal forces and, I mean, when you militarize the security strategy, when you reinforce that strategy, you will have an increase in the levels of violence. The argument is that in Ciudad Juarez, you saw that in the year 2010 and then in the first part of the year 2011, but then violence went down. This is one explanation, and this is why, you know, the involvement of the federal forces and the reinforced strategy would be, it's considered like appropriate. However, if we see, as you mentioned, that strategy involves a lot of violations of human rights because you put like the armed forces to do activities they're not prepared to do, which is public safety, public security.
Oh, you mean so giving the military responsibility over policing the state as opposed to acting as a military force, acting as a law enforcement force?
Exactly. We have the experience of Juarez, but we have also had the experience in the same state of Tamaulipas, reinforcing since 2010, we had these increases in the numbers of Marine and the Army in the different in the main cities and the main parts, I mean the most violent parts of the state. We haven't seen a real result because there are other things that are needed. Allegedly, the case of Juarez has been relatively successful due to the fact that after all this process of violence and violation of human rights, now violence seems to be in a trend of decreasing trend. Well, in the case of Michoacán, the increase in the resources the strategy, like the militarization of the state and the involvement of bigger numbers of federal forces didn't bring any result because in the end of Cadena administration, in the beginning of Peña Nieto's administration, we saw all these self-defense groups and the Knights Templar controlling the whole state. And no matter how many resources have been spent during the Calderon administration. Let's remember that Michoacán was one of the priorities of President Calderon when he declared the war on drugs. So we see two different models, right? And in Ciudad Juarez, we're not sure that violence went down because of the action of the federal forces or because, you know, because of the fact that one cartel now dominates the plaza. It was a fight between the Juarez cartel and the Sinaloa cartel, and now one clearly has more leverage and the other one has lost a lot of strength because of this conflict. We don't really know if succeed was because of the armed forces, you know, operating and, you know, being successful, and that was a successful strategy. In the case of Tamaulipas, we are seeing more of the same. The involvement of federal forces, the enforcement of the strategy, like, you know, bringing more effectives of the Navy and the Army, is not a new thing. This has happened since 2010. There are more things that need to be done for this to be sustainable.
Right.
First of all, you know, involving just the federal forces without a plan to finish with these, you know, emergency measures, it's very important, and it was not laid out in the plan that the federal government, you know, presented in Reynosa. We don't know when this is going to finish because the Navy and the Army cannot. I mean, these are performing activities that are not. I mean, that they are not qualified to do. So the police has to come to the state. You need to clean the police. You need to do the police reform at the same time that you have these operations. We're having like end of these operations, right? There was nothing about that. There was nothing about police reform, how the police reform is going to be done, how you're going to incorporate again, you know,
right,
so local police to their places. So there's no plan to reconstruct the institutions.
One thing about Tamaulipas, too, is that there's so little coverage in the media of Tamaulipas because of the extreme censorship there, which is different from, I think, Michoacan in Chihuahua, right? I mean, very few Mexican journalists from the capital go there, very few U.S. journalists. So my worry is that with this increasing militarization and if there are human rights abuses, how will the word get out to the international community? And are we going to see more people seeking asylum in the U.S.? That worries me.
Definitely. I am also extremely concerned with militarization, the silencing of the media in the state of Tamaulipas that has been historically, controlled. Because as you remember, in the past several decades, one group of organized crime, the Gulf Cartel, controlled the social, economic, and political activities. So the level of activism and the reporting, and you know, the media has been controlled by this group. We don't have the network. And as you mentioned correctly, with militarization, more people are going to be, you know, scared. Of course, people are very afraid, and they're going to be more afraid reporting. I mean, there's always this alternative, which is the social media. However, in the social media, it's sometimes not very clear who's who either. So definitely, you will have probably, you know, more violence, more violation of human rights, less communication of what is going on, and definitely more people are going to probably look for asylum, but I'm not sure that the asylum is going to be provided to them, because we have seen more people are looking for asylum, but less offerings of visas in the United States side.
Well, our guest is UT Brownsville Professor Correa Cabrera. Thank you so much for being on the show, and thank you for sharing the story, Melissa.
Thanks so much, Lupita.
Oh, you're welcome.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music. And of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Schulz. For more Texas news and culture, you can visit us on the web at texasobserver.org, or you can pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk to you again next time on Observer Radio.